This week on Death of the Reader, it's all about romance as we see the crime come to a head. We'll speak to Shuming Tao about classical romance and see if these Frenchmen were quite as deluded as they seem. All that and more, now on Death of the Reader.
You're listening to Death of the Reader on 2SER. We are Flex and Herds, and it's time to farewell the Widow LaRouge, as we have reached, in fact, the end of her case. Over the past 3 weeks, we've been speaking about all of the dastardly schemes and conniving servants that led to her demise and the framing of the Viscount, Albert de Comerin. But Herds...
Flex?
It was all just a big coincidence.
Yeah. Also, the title is a lie. The Widow LaRouge is not a widow. None of the clues matter for anything. This is the fun part about this novel, and actually why I enjoyed reading it so much, especially last week getting to chat to you and being like, why do you think that the broken foil has been missing and that they found the kid gloves and there's the money boots and the... It doesn't matter. The answer doesn't matter. It just happened to all be occurring at the same time. Albert was like... yo, I'm going to go and see my sweetheart. And I was like, I'm going to kill a widow who isn't actually a widow. And then he left his stuff on the train.
I know. Like, the thing is on the one hand, I feel like I should be furious about the fact that none of the clues mattered at all.
Are you furious, though?
Because,
this is the question.
Because, like, there wasn't really any foreshadowing, I thought, as to the fact that everything was just happened, right?
No, there wasn't.
However, everything Tabaret said was a coincidence.
Yeah. I mean, he literally would talk about, this is the son who has been switched with the other son, but they hadn't actually. That's what we find out later, of course. And he's just living right near now. No, like, the whole book is a big bag of coincidences.
It is.
Right from the beginning.
And I was mad about it. I was, like, genuinely frustrated with, like, I put in all of this goddamn effort, and you're telling me he just left it on the train?
He just left all of the evidence on the train, and then they found it, and, like, he had a little name tag saying, I am the murderer, and he left it on the train, but then it turned out that Albert also had a name tag that said, I am the murderer. But it was, like, misspelled a little bit. And so they were like, yo, Mara, we got you. Nailed it. Going to jail. Getting hanged.
But yeah, after that reread, I was like, oh, it was all coincidences. And he was just open about that the whole time.
Also, the power of love. Which I love.
No.
Look. No. Yes, it is. It is the power of love. I love this novel so much. I had the biggest, dumbest grin on my face. I was like, is this all just going to not matter? And it's going to be that the pure and innocent woman character who can't do anything on her own but loves a man so much, she's going to come in and save him? This is great. I loved it.
I'm not sure whether the, like, way that this story presents love is self-aware. Because everyone is just... absolutely delusional. You know, we have this entire scene where every time the love interest is introduced with Daburon, with Noel, with Albert, just all of their romances are all horrible to them.
Yeah.
They're blindly devoting themselves.
Yeah. I mean, that's the idea of, like, romance, right? This is a part where, you know, like, this was written in the 19th century. The idea of romance, that you devote yourself 100% to someone. Like, Albert lies about not having an alibi because he doesn't want to hurt the person he loved or betray her trust, which it, like, is what allows him to escape in the end, because she comes to the magistrate of her own accord and says, oh, I am here in my white dress and my ghostly pale figure. Let me tell you all of the truths. Oh, you see, magistrate. And that's the scene. I hope you enjoyed that voice, by the way.
Oh, my goodness. It was... Well, I think if it was, like, one or two of the characters that had this style of relationship, and then there was another example of, like, a better relationship, so we could kind of laugh at the difference between them, then I'd feel it was more tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
Because it's all of them, it feels like, is it taking itself seriously? Which is a bit weird.
Well, especially we have the reveal from Juliet, which is something it's kind of subtly is in air quotes, but
there is very
Juliet,
little subtlety.
You know, is saying, oh, how you bore me, Noel. You just give me money and you never let me see your friends. And then in the end, when he comes to her and is like, yo, we gotta run. I am wanted by the police. I am being hunted like an animal, which is great, by the way. That chapter where it describes Noel and his, like, his mindset as he's like stumbling through the streets and people are looking at him, he's getting paranoid. That is a fantastic chapter.
Yeah.
It is completely different from everything else in the book. It feels like you're in the mind of a killer who knows their court, you know? And I love that. It's so good. Really ties into what I've been saying about how this novel, its biggest strength is not the mystery. It's like how we feel like these are like real people to an extent, at least. There is that tongue in cheek nature to it. But Juliet says, "But I've loved you this whole time." And she goes, "Let's run away together." But they spend about 10 minutes trying to pick up all her jewelry. And that's when the police rock up. So really, he doomed himself through love, which is great.
Well, I think the thing that you've reminded me of there is, once again, Knox's first rule that the culprit must be mentioned in the early part of the story. But we don't often address the following part of that rule, which is, they must not be anyone whose thoughts the reader has been allowed to follow.
Yeah.
Right? Mm. Now, one thing I noticed early in the story is that when we go to meet Juliet for the first time, we explicitly never get Noel's thoughts in that scene, which I was one of the reasons I was suspicious of him, because I was like, okay, we're obviously keeping a more third-person perspective than we were for Tabaret or anyone else. But I really liked that once the story was confident and open with the fact that it's Noel, then it's like, here's in his head.
It's beautiful. It speaks to the kind of quaintness of the novel. You can tell that it's not as refined. It doesn't, you know, follow as many conventions as a modern, you know, crime novel, but it has an undeniable sense of fun as we follow these characters.
Yeah. I think the other thing with all of those characters that we kind of had thrown to but never actually showed up is that maybe they were originally meant to show up.
Maybe.
But because it was a serialized story and, you know, this was the kind of era where it would have been much easier for a Parisian to write a letter to Gaboriau and say like, oh, I loved this part of your novel. You know, maybe he got a bunch of letters that were like, Noel's an excellent character. And he's like, all right, he's the bad guy.
Yeah, maybe.
Or, you know, maybe a bunch of his letters didn't actually address the guy with the earring at all. So he kind of put him to the wayside. Because it's a serialized release, there can be a lot more dynamic push and pull from the audience, I think, of how that story develops over time, and a lot more of a dynamic way that the author can explore where their head's at. As we were talking with Sean Britton in the final part of The Floating Admiral, one of the things that's difficult between sequels and all sorts of things is that you as an author have changed, and how does that change the way you write?
Well, it leads to a lot of exciting moments. As I say, the chase scene of you know, catching the criminal is often kind of superfluous and kind of tacked on the end. And like in a movie especially, it's, you know, it's all about the spectacle. Let's see how many snipers Sherlock can dodge as he heads after Moriarty. Whatever, he's going to catch him or he's, and who
cares? I don't remember that part of the book.
I'm pretty sure that was in the second Robert Downey Jr. movie. There was a scene like that. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
I know that one.
The book's less so. But one of my favorite scenes, which was like pretty darn superfluous, was when Tabaret is chasing after Juliet in the cab or whatever. And he's like, follow that blue bonnet. And the driver in his head is like, oh, I see. He's found out his woman is with another man. And then he chases her for 20 francs. And then he's like, oh, she's getting away. And his mind, the cab driver is saying, oh, well, I'm on the side of the woman usually in these cases. But for 40 francs, I'll chase it down for you. And it's this very silly, like, I don't even remember. I don't think he got a name, the cab driver, but he was one of the funniest characters, just with only three lines all in his head. It was beautiful. But as you say, there are some weaknesses. And I think that the biggest weakness that I kind of found was in the ending where they have the like, oh, the murderer's killed himself, but they have just enough strength to write a confession. So everything can be put to right. And the couple, the like romantic interests, can get together, and that's it. And it just kind of trails off with like Tabaret. I think there's a nice little nod to Tabaret saying that he then, you know, was more interested in cases where guilt was not 100% prescribed, which is nice. But it definitely feels more like, it's like we got to the second last chapter of the book, we had our climax, and then we jump straight to like the post-credit scene. Like there should be a scene between those two things saying this is how we wrap up all the, I don't know. I feel like it just wrapped up like very quickly and strangely. I don't know if you felt the same or not.
I do agree with that. I think that we've been complimenting the book over the previous 2 weeks about how consistent it was in tone.
As we should.
And I think that was true right up until that part where you mentioned where suddenly it's like, hold on, what's just happened? Where have we jumped?
Yeah.
But, and I'll speak about this a bit in the third part, I don't think that it's entirely unjustified. You know, it can feel a little bit weird, but it's one of those things where in the detective story, realistically what happens is that, you know, the culprit gets caught, life goes on.
Yeah.
And how do you wrap that up tidily? There's not as much of an event after the culprit's been caught. But right now, Herds, it's time to jump over to Shuming Teo, professor from Macquarie University and an expert on romantics who can hopefully set us straight about what's going on with all these damn love stories. This is Death of the Reader.
You're listening to Death of the Reader on 2SER. This is Flex and Herds, with more guest talent here to sweep you off your feet and teach you about romance. We have Associate Professor Shuming Teo, author of Desert Passions, Orientalism, and Romance Novels, Behind the Moon, and Love and Vertigo, the latter of which earned the Vogel Award in 1999. Shuming, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you here. How are you doing today?
I'm pretty good.
That's good, that's good. We're here to discuss the LaRouche case, which, as I enjoy, has a strong romantic focus. The killer has a strong drive to pursue the woman he loves by any means. Shuming, how does the romantic genre blend itself with the genre of detective fiction?
There are a lot of crossovers. We probably trace the modern detective novel with romantic elements back to the 1920s and 1930s with Georgette Heyer's novels. Right, so Georgette Heyer wrote Regency romances, but she also wrote detective fiction during the golden age of detective fiction. So she was among, I guess, the writers that your listeners are probably familiar with: Agatha Christie, Marjorie Ollingham, Patricia Wentworth, Niall Marsh, Dorothy Sayers. So she was among those, but her detective fiction tended to have romantic subplots as well. The 19th century was the great age of romance. It's when the romantic novel first begins right across Europe. But I think romance back then did not mean the happy ever after that it does today. So I guess we call it love stories nowadays, but the 19th century was a great believer in love stories. So I think this whole notion that you've got to pair up, your couple in order to have some kind of resolution, that's probably very 19th century.
I think the other thing that was interesting, particularly about the LaRouche case, as you were talking about how it's, you know, love was more of a tragedy and less passion-based back in the 19th century, a lot of the relationships and romances we have going on in the LaRouche case end up being fruitless or seemingly critiquing the way people treat each other. For example, one of the main characters in the novel, Noelle, his romance is very much one-sided, where he's just giving this woman everything that he has and getting nothing in return. How is that reflected in the romantic genre at the time, and how much is that reflected in other works?
Okay. That's coming straight out of Romanticism, like Goethe's Werther, the Sorrows of the Young Werther. The 19th century was an age where people really believed in unrequited love. Right, and this is the purest form of love, and the purest ending to a love story is a tragedy, because that makes your emotions that much sharper than if they were all to end happily ever after. So the fact that you have unrequited love, I think, is quite common in 19th century love stories. And today, of course, it's completely different. You get over the person that you were in love with. The 19th century wouldn't have liked that, because love is not supposed to commoditize the beloved, right? That they become interchangeable with the next one that comes along, you know. So you're sort of looking at, well, I've fallen in love with this person. If they don't return my feelings, that's really sad, and I grieve a bit, but then I move on to the next one, because there is the next one. So that's how we think of it today, and it's probably healthier. But back then, the person that you fell in love with was supposed to be the ideal. It was the one and only. And if they didn't return your love, then you just lived this blighted life. But if you fell in love with someone else and moved on, then they would have questioned, was that really love to begin with?
Yeah, it sounds to me almost like that is a result of the commonality of arranged marriages back in those days. Do you think that that is true, and how does that manifest itself?
By the 19th century, arranged marriages were not that common. So people were starting to marry for love, particularly among the middle classes, which is, of course, the readership for your novel. People had a lot more choice. But I think one of the reasons why we see love and courtship featuring so heavily in the 19th century novel, in all kinds of genres, is because people were trying to work out, well, what does it mean to fall in love, to be in love, and to marry for love? Marriage for love, you know, what they call the love match, places a lot of responsibility on individuals. If your parents arrange your marriage, if you were not happy, well, that's on them. It's not your fault. But if you're responsible for falling in love and for making a choice of a partner based on your feelings of love, then you probably want to know what does being in love actually mean. And so there is a lot of literature, a lot of writing about what does it mean to be in love in the 19th century, not just in fiction, but also in advice manuals, in literary periodicals as well, even in newspapers. We still have talk about love, but it's more about managing. It's within the self-help genre. But in the 19th century, it really was exploratory because the stakes were so high, especially for women.
Mm. We've spoken a fair bit with this book about how it critiques the aristocracy and the upper class of the time, and I think that change where the middle class was starting to marry more for love, whereas the upper class was maybe lagging a bit behind there, and the arranged marriage of the more noble people in the book definitely reflects that.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked a lot about the history. Obviously, you've written quite a few texts on romance. Why are you so interested in the topic of romance? What sparked that creative?
Oh, well, okay. So my first novel, Love and Vertigo, is really about, it's really the anti-romance of the family. So it's about the falling apart of the family. But one of the reasons why, I guess, the family falls apart is how the family got together in the first place. So the narrator's mother was of that first generation from Singapore society who got educated and then who married for love or what she thought was love. But it's clear in that novel that what she imagines to be love is what she has learned from reading love poetry, British love poetry particularly, and the movies as well. So it's this whole discourse of love, right? So I think I'm really interested in how love is represented, how it's changed over time, because it's something that people think it's natural. Everybody thinks that they know something about love. Right, that they're an expert of in matters of love because of their own experiences. And yet when we look at the history of love and what it means and the ideas that are attached to it, this changes over time, right? So if the ideas change, the emotions change as well. So for example, today we are quite reluctant to think about a lot of pain as being a part, a normal part of love. In the 19th century, you couldn't have love without having pain because the suffering process was supposed to, accentuate the experience of love, right? So that's one thing that is really quite different. Mm. The way people express love also differs significantly. So there's one of my favourite anecdotes is an early modern scholar who looks at Welsh traditions of love. And he says that, well, in this village in Wales and in the Middle Ages, how young men would express their love or attraction for a young woman, it would be to pee on her dress, right? It's a practice that it's called rithu, rhythu. Now, today we think that, that it was assault, that it expresses contempt, right? It's completely
not very classy.
It's completely the opposite.
Yeah.
But it just shows that love has a cultural history and how it's expressed is actually very much determined by culture. Yeah. So that's why I'm really interested, I guess, in the topic.
That's an excellent answer. Yeah. Makes me wonder what sort of strange new things we'll be doing in the near future to express our love to each other. Hopefully not taking lessons from the Welsh.
No, not in that regard anyway. Maybe from your novel.
Maybe, right? Maybe. Mm-hmm. We'll throw all our money at someone and then get shot at the end. Anyway, that won't be pleasant. Yeah, I've heard you describe crime and romance fiction today as a flourishing subgenre. What makes you say that? Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Okay, so as I said, crime and romance as genres or subgenres start to intermingle from the 1930s onwards in the novels of Georgette Heyer. And they, there's a sort of lag in the 20th century, the mid-20th century, when it's really about the gothic and the romance. But when the romance genre takes off, especially in the 1980s, so this is when the genre becomes Americanized, there's a whole lot of American writers, they're bestsellers, and they're writing romance, and then the romance ceases to be sufficiently interesting for what they want to do. And so they start including elements of crime in, because I said before that in the mid-20th century, how people depict passion, romance, love is through the battle of the sexes. But how do you get, you know, if you don't want your hero and heroine to be fighting all the time, how do you get them to work together? And one of the ways that romance writers did, was to combine romance with crime, because then you've got the detective or whoever it is, you know, the good guy working with the heroine to solve some kind of crime.
It's solving the mystery, not just of the case, but also of each other's hearts.
I
one might say,
that's very romantic.
Thank you.
Anyway, well, that's a lot of recommendations in there for things you can check out. And thank you so much for coming on the show.
You're very welcome. And thanks for having me.
This has been Death of the Reader. We are talking the LaRouche case, and we'll be back in just a second. You're on 2SER. This is Death of the Reader. We are Flex and Herds, bringing you a murder mystery world tour. And this week is the final episode for the LaRouche case.
And the end for Noel, the lovely good boy who nobody hated and that was definitely innocent of all crimes. Right, right, Flex?
Absolutely.
It was that awful old woman who died halfway through the novel.
So this is the part of the show where we talk about what we thought of the puzzle, how fair it was, how absolutely goddamn right I was, ish.
Whatever. It's just going to happen every second week, so don't just get used to it, guys. Just buckle in and get ready for the ride of him. Yeah. Just tell me how smart he is.
I'll just put on my smug glasses and we'll carry on.
Yeah, it's awful.
I don't think I can take as much credit for being right about this novel as we could have for the previous novels we've covered, because, as we said earlier in the episode, it's just an absolute pile of coincidences and practically tells you what's going on.
It's great. I love it. This is my favorite murder mystery where, like, the mystery drives the plot. It brings us to this moral of, like, love conquers all, but also can bring you to your downfall. That's a cool thing to explore. But the mystery isn't, like, the entire point of the novel, which I know is heresy to say on a murder mystery show, but, like, that's just how I be. I love murder mystery. I love puzzling stuff out. But if that is the entire point, I don't feel like... I don't know. I want that emotional connection. I want that, like, moral lesson at the end.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things with detective fiction, of course, is that there are only so many ways you can lock a door and put a corpse behind it. And
damn right.
I think that having variety in the genre is not a bad thing, even if it does lead to some cheap feeling puzzles like this. But as you say, the puzzle is not the core of the story in the same way it is in others.
Mm-hmm.
That said, one of the things that I love most about the puzzles in murder mysteries is going back over them and seeing, like, this is where this was foreshadowed. This is where this was foreshadowed. Your second read is like a completely different experience. Mm-hmm. And despite how, like, tacky the puzzle was in this novel, I think this has been one of the best rereads of a murder mystery I've had.
Yeah.
Because you get to go back and see all of the other stuff that's going on in a new light. And because it's still a mystery, you still have that uncovering experience that you would with a conventional whodunity golden age type story.
For me, as the veteran, going back and rereading it, my favorite part was reading Noel's lines, particularly when he's interacting with the counts.
Mm.
When he's talking to anyone, he is like deadpanning it. You know,
yeah,
like,
it's fantastic.
He's a psychopath. Mm. Watching this battle between the two good boys of the story, Albert and Noel, and seeing how Albert is completely clean. He does everything chivalrously and romantically. And then Noel, who's like, oh, don't worry. I'll get Albert out of prison. I'm sure that I'll do that. I don't think he ever says, I will catch the culprit. He just says, I will get Albert out, which is one of those fun things of, we don't really know whether he's, like, he's obviously not, you know, he's not going to, you know, out himself, but, like, maybe he did want to get Albert out of that situation. Maybe he really did want to say, oh, well, it's somebody else. It's person X, you know, it wasn't me, it wasn't Albert. But, like, looking through his dialogue and seeing all the times that he lies to people and see that undercurrent of his debt to Claire Jo and Juliet and all that stuff. It's fantastic to read over. And yeah, I hope you enjoyed that as well.
Yeah, I have about like 4 annotations for every single page of the book. Mm. And every single one of them that is a Noel piece of dialogue has a voids thing next to it.
Yes.
Because every line he says, as you say, is dodging an issue. And it's one of those things, I picked up on it on the way, but I didn't realize how egregious it was until a reread. And I really love going back over and being like, oh, and he didn't mention that, and this one.
Yep.
It was a fantastic experience.
It's really great.
I think one of the other things that I really loved about Noel earlier in the story is that when we first meet Juliet, I realized on a reread, there isn't even really a clarification on when that scene is happening.
No, not really, no.
You know, obviously it says 8 days until I've resolved this, but it never says what that resolution is, and there are multiple events in the novel that it could be leading up towards.
True.
It does kind of reveal it a bit later in the book.
Claire Jo, he has a conversation with Claire Jo where he says that, you know, oh, I will pay back your debts. I just need you to give me an extra week and I'll have all the money I could ever want.
I really enjoyed going back over and seeing this was positioned here in the story. And then all of the reasoning I'd done about what if this was a time jump to after the crime or before the crime or here, there, or elsewhere. It really wrapped it up nicely on a reread. And
yeah.
I think that's perhaps the prime example of a scene that I enjoyed on a reread.
Sure, yeah.
But here we are, Herds, to rate the fairness of this story. And I have to say,
oh no,
I have never witnessed a greater essay upon Rule 6 of the Nox Decalogue.
Oh my goodness, which rule is Rule 6?
No accident must ever help the detective.
Yeah.
Nor must he ever have an unaccountable intuition.
Yeah, that's just
which proves to be right.
That's just this novel in a nutshell. It's just Rule 6. I am like convinced that Nox wrote that rule after reading this novel.
I genuinely would not be surprised.
It's great.
The thing is like, if you were to read this rule as no accident must ever help the detective, right? Cool. Yeah. That's a good rule.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you add on the nor must he ever have an unaccountable intuition,
he does that all the time.
That's a little more suspicious. That's a little more this novel.
Yeah, sure.
Then which proves to be right, that's this novel.
Yeah.
Hands down.
I mean, it's nothing but coincidences and him saying, what if this is a plot thing? And then it just is a plot thing. And that's the novel.
Mm. Now, while we're on the topic of Nox rules, I have one last one that I have to bring up, Herds.
Go for it.
Not more than one secret room or passage is allowable.
Yeah, there was only one. It was just the one in Noel's house.
I loved the way they used Noel's one. Because, like, it was, like, chapter 5, and they're just like, here it is.
Yeah.
And then it was, the onus was upon the story to use it again in an entertaining way.
Yeah.
And the way it used it.
Yeah.
Ugh.
The valet, like, complains. It's fantastic.
It was just so good, because earlier in the story, when it was first introduced, it was like, so that no one would know that he's leaving the building. And then later on, the valet is just like, ah, no, he's using the door again.
Yeah, he complains about it. He's like, oh, why is Noel using the secret passage? I thought that he would rather come through the front door. I suppose he's trying to save me some trouble with my paw aching back. It's so good.
It's excellent. So, ultimately, I guess I have to, do I call this book fair or not, Herds?
I don't know, like,
do you call this book fair?
I suppose so. It gives us all the clues. It's just that all those clues are coincidence. I don't know, I mean,
I think the main thing to me about whether I'm deciding whether or not this story is fair is that I need to know what the blurb on the back of the book said in the publication of this, because I've been reading an ebook which didn't have it because it was a public domain copy.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, would have had a blurb? It was serialized.
Obviously, that's not like, that doesn't change what the book is, but I think that I came in with too different of an expectation to this story than it wanted me to come in.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, that's the kind of trick with any, like, any novel in general, really, but especially with like, mystery novels. If you, you know, you come in expecting there to be, you know, a very light mystery and it turns out to be incredibly complicated, you're like, well, this isn't the novel I signed up for. If someone tells you, you know, this is a story about love or whatever, you might be more primed to figure out the mystery. And that's kind of one of the challenges, especially on my end, when I'm the veteran of, like, trying to lead you through the story without just saying, like, I was, you know, teasing a little bit in the second part, mainly, I think, talk about how, like, oh, romance really is the true power here. But, like, I wasn't really setting expectations for you. I was just teasing. Because that's what I do.
I mean, and that's fine. That's what we're here to do.
It's true. It's true.
But you know what we're here to do now, Herds?
Tell us.
We're
Flex.
Here to pick a new book.
Now you get to do that this time.
I do. I will be the veteran this time. I'm doing something a little weird this week.
What? This wasn't weird?
This is weirder.
Okay, throw it at me.
I have three books for you. Well, three stories for you.
Three stories? How are we supposed to do three stories in 3 weeks?
So, next week, we will be covering House in the Mist by Anna Katharine Green. The edition of the publication we have contains House in the Mist, The Ruby in the Cauldron, and The Hermit of Blank Street.
blank street, does that mean that it doesn't have a name? Or is that the name? That's the name of the street?
That's for you to discover.
That's crazy.
Next week, we'll just be covering chapter one of The House in the Mist. But we'll roll on through those other stories in the following week. So make sure you keep an eye on our socials at Flex and Herds to know which stories we're covering as well as listening to the show.
Well, I'm looking forward to try and solve not one, not two, but three stories.
Indeed.
My goodness, my work is cut out for me. See if I can beat you this time, you rapscallion.
Indeed. Thank you so much for joining us for the LaRouge case. We are Flex and Herds. This has been Death of the Reader. See you next time.